Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Today on Health Styles, we're going to focus on two issues that are ostensibly on women's health, but I would argue that both are relevant for anyone concerned about the health and well-being of women, children, and their families. We'll start with an interview I did with Dr. Diana Taylor, Professor Emerita at the University of California at San Francisco School of Nursing and Research Faculty for the Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health program. We talk about the implications of the 2014 elections for women's access to reproductive health services and about strategies to increase this access that are underway in California and could serve as a model for other states. On the second half of Health Styles, Dr. Diane Spatz, Professor of Perinatal Nursing, and the Helen M. Shearer Term Professor of Nutrition at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, talks with me about some of the latest scientific findings about breastfeeding, including some fascinating information about how breast milk can actually be used as a therapeutic intervention for sick infants who cannot eat. For listeners who are not women of childbearing age, I encourage you to listen to these interviews with the intention of learning what we all can do to protect and promote the health of families. You may have a friend, a neighbor, a niece, or a daughter-in-law who is struggling with some of these issues and needs support and encouragement. In addition, it will take all of us to develop the public and private policies around reproductive health and breastfeeding to reduce these struggles. Let's start with my interview about reproductive health.
The results of the November national and state elections suggest that we will continue to see efforts to restrict women's right to abortion and access to contraception and abortion services. But even in states where the right to abortion seems safeguarded, access to abortion services may be limited. And here to talk with us about these issues is Dr. Diana Taylor, a registered nurse and professor of nursing at the University of California at San Francisco and senior faculty at the UCSF Bixby Center for Reproductive Health. Diana, thank you so much for joining us today on Health Styles.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Good. So, and we are two Dianas. And
a great name.
Yes, a great name. So look, I do want to start with these elections and the fact that there is this an analysis that there is this disconnect between who has been elected. We are increasingly electing conservative policymakers, and yet on issues that were on ballots in states, the message from the voters was very much in keeping with what some might see as the platform more of a left-leaning political spectrum, and including on the issue of access to reproductive health and women's reproductive rights. And I bring up, for example, North Dakota, that's, you know, a conservative state, and yet the voters voted down the personhood amendment as they did in Colorado. Maybe you could start by talking a little bit about that, what the personhood amendment is, and any other examples of how there may be this disconnect between who our policymakers are and how the voters feel about issues.
Oh, yes, it's just we really are living in the worst of times, and it's about regulating healthcare, and particularly healthcare that's specific to women. And all of this legislation that is occurring at the state level is all related to abortion, but hidden behind it is really restrictions on sexual health and sexual and reproductive health that will affect not only women but their families. And let me give you some examples of what it means to have rights without access to essential sexual and reproductive health services in the U.S. And I am talking about the U.S. because we can look to our international neighbors in Canada and the U.K. and Scandinavia, many other countries where contraception and abortion and sex education and teen care of young mothers is integrated and is not restricted in the same way that where it's politically restricted in the U.S. So, for example, more than 3 million low-income women are living without health insurance because their state has not expanded Medicaid coverage. And in only 14 states do they use Medicaid funds for contraception and abortion. And then we have the highest rate of unintended pregnancy in any of the industrialized world. And our national goal for lowering this rate really hasn't budged in 30 years.
Which is what, you know, it's another irony in all of this that on the one hand we have policymakers who want to restrict abortions and access to abortions. On the other hand, they want to restrict access to contraception. And what do they want? Women barefoot and pregnant all the time? It doesn't make sense. It's not logical.
No, it doesn't make sense. And now we have... There are two areas that are really trying to restrict, more services to women than just abortion. For example, the consolidation of hospitals and medical centers in which the only available center is a religiously affiliated one, and many women are unable to access contraceptive services or even treatment for emergency miscarriages or complications arising from abortions because none of their doctors and nurses are trained to treat those problems. So they're really providing unsafe care. And the Supreme Court of the United States now has endorsed for-profit corporate control over our personal contraceptive decisions, and which will impose an incredible financial burden on low-wage workers. And that's estimated. We even know the cost of that will cost $600 a year when these corporations use religion to discriminate on contraceptive coverage.
So the personhood amendment, my understanding is that it would give, to have a state pass an amendment to its constitution granting personhood to fetuses, which would then make unconstitutional abortion. Do I have that right?
Yes. So it's, again, there's more constitutional rights for a fetus than for the woman carrying that fetus.
Yeah. And back to your point about access to contraception and affordability, I just want to share, there's a young woman who I know who I have... as she has been growing up, talked with her about the need to make sure that if she is having sex that she's protected. And so she knows about using condoms and expecting her boyfriend to use condoms. And I had asked her, so, you know, you're still using condoms. In fact, I would, because New York City was providing them for free, I would take them home with me when I visited my family and would give her...
Like
free.
A good public health nurse.
Yes, would give her, and much to the dismay of some members of my family, would give her free condoms. Well, she... told me this one time I asked that they weren't using them because they couldn't afford them. She's in school. She's working to try to support herself. He's in school. And I was like, what do you mean you can't afford them? You know, I'm thinking maybe a dollar. She pointed out that indeed one box of condoms that, you know, didn't even have 10 in them cost $17 and change. And right. I couldn't quite believe it, so I went into a drugstore and priced them, and she was absolutely right. And this is a young woman with no spare change.
That's right. And, you know, now we do have, under the Affordable Care Act, there is that contraceptives must be provided without a copay, and except for the provision of these religiously held, these religious corporations, essentially.
And do we have any read yet on how many corporations are claiming religious exemption?
No, I'm sorry, I don't have information on that. That's still being developed. But I think Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually predicted that this would become a bigger problem than was projected by the attorneys for these corporations.
And that was in the way that some corporations would be asking to be exempted for providing care for somebody with some other issue, correct?
Right.
Yeah. So it's a very difficult landscape politically. But even in states where, you know, the right to access to abortion services is not under siege, it may not be that easy to get an abortion because of who's available to provide that service. Is that right?
That's right. You know, abortion is federally protected by the U.S. Constitution, but each state has to codify the federal law, as well as, you know, each state regulates health care and health professionals, and so that we can be assured of safe, effective, quality health care. And so as it relates to abortion, many states, when they were codifying Roe v. Wade, they wrote state regulations that restricted abortion provision to only physicians rather than to licensed healthcare providers. And so therefore, except in a handful of states where that didn't happen, there are criminal penalties should a licensed provider other than a physician, and in some states, other than a specialist physician like an OBGYN physician, can perform an abortion.
So in California, you've done work that sort of that actually extends who can provide abortion services. Tell us about what you've done.
Yes. Just as background, there were 1,100 legislative bills introduced in state legislatures over the past 2 years that have limited, you know, where an abortion can be provided, what a healthcare provider must say and do, regardless of whether it's science-based. And most importantly, these laws have really kept women from making their own choices and decisions about, you know, how they want to deal with an unintended pregnancy. So except for our legislation in California, none of these legislative actions focused on the real issue, which was to improve women's access to safe, quality, and early abortion care by trained, safe, licensed practitioners provided in health services that are close to their homes. I mean, that's sort of the gold standard for any type of health care that we provide. So because I'm a nurse and because I am an educator of health professionals, both primary care professionals, whether they're nurses or physicians. There were a group of us at the University of California that wanted to, you know, try to solve this problem in the same way that we solve any other lack of health care service that's needed by people, in this case, women. You know, 1 out of 3 women in the U.S. will have an abortion by the time they're 40. 46 million women a year have an abortion, you know, that they, across the globe. So this is, you know, abortion is a normal part of healthcare, and in the U.S., at least for now, it's still legal. So we developed a study, a demonstration project, to evaluate the safety and acceptability and effectiveness of primary care clinicians as abortion providers. And that So these were family physicians, nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, and physician's assistants, all licensed providers in the state. And so we conducted this study under the auspices of the Office of State Health Planning of California, because we needed a legal waiver to, it's a catch-22. You can't train and evaluate a person doing an illegal procedure. And
I might point out that California is a bit unique in that it does have this opportunity to test out different roles for health professionals, getting exemptions from scope of practice laws while they do the pilot. But once you have the data, the pilot's done, the standing law prevails, and you have to change the laws or the regulations if
exactly.
the study was successful and you have the evidence to then change the scope of practice of the health professional.
Exactly. And so normally you don't have to go through all of these hoops if you're training new providers in new skills. It's done in the usual way. But abortion's unfortunately regulated outside of the usual way in which healthcare practice is advanced. Mm. And so what we thought that just by submitting our data and our results, which clearly showed that these clinicians are safe and can provide this this care effectively, and it's the largest study of its kind on the provision of abortion care by primary care providers, mm. and that we could change, that would be it, that we would, the usual way that health professionals change their practice is to have it be recognized by the state licensing boards, and but there's so much anti-abortion politics, and that it was felt that the only way to really have this be codified was to have it be legislatively, have it be changed within the abortion statute. And so that's what happened in 2013, and so the law has just gone into effect in January of 2014 of this year, and that allows there's two bills, actually. One was AB 154, which allows nurse practitioners and nurse midwives and physician's assistants to provide abortion care by medication or aspiration, and it's restricted to first trimester abortion. And then the second piece of legislation, which is equally as important, which it removed restrictions on facilities where abortion is provided, and that was AB Assembly Bill 980, so that abortions which is could be provided in primary care clinics, because this is a very safe procedure that can be provided out of a hospital and or out of a surgical center.
So this the law was passed in 2013. Has it been operational yet?
Yes. Yes, it has. There are close to 50 providers who are practicing in the state, and
50 additional ones?
Yeah, through our study, and uh-huh. so that they're able to continue to practice, uh-huh. and then the next step is for other, and then also they can be provided outside of a surgical center, mm-hmm. and so they are able to expand the trainees, the people who were trained, that they. They're able to provide abortions within the context of their regular women's health care. So it's not just in a standalone clinic. It's mm-hmm. just part of regular health care. And then clinicians who were trained outside or, have that that skill set already and have demonstrated their competency, that they're able to practice as well.
So this could actually be a model for other states.
We hope so. That was our goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So obviously, though, the political climate plays a role in this, because if you still have to get support for the passage of laws in the state to make this happen, and the political landscape is such right now that there are probably fewer states that are poised to adopt this model. Do you have any states right now that you know of that are talking about moving forward in this direction?
Yes, but I'm not sure I want to say.
Okay, I understand that.
On the radio show.
Yes.
But, you know, because it is chilling, you know,
yeah.
There are major barriers. No other type of health care
yeah.
do we provide where a provider can be murdered,
yeah.
can be attacked. I mean, it's very, these courageous clinicians who provide these services in the face of that. But there are, you know, there are the states that we know that don't have restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
They're expanding their, like Oregon and Washington and Vermont and New Hampshire, Montana. They are getting more support to expand their training of clinicians. And
I hope New York's on that list.
Actually, New York is really rates fairly high in terms of sexual and reproductive health and abortion care. But in terms of expanding the pool of qualified providers, that New York is not progressive in that regard. In fact, you know, for various reasons, haven't put forward this type of legislation.
That's very interesting. One would hope that we would be on that list of states. We'll have to look into that.
But in terms of New York, I think that the New York has been the leader in primary care physicians' training of abortion care, and so there's been an increased pool of primary care physicians who are abortion providers, which is laudable.
So this would require that educational programs for nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, and physicians' assistants would include this content on how to do aspiration or medication abortions in their curriculum. So if that's the case, has there been pushback from the schools or from students?
No, in fact, the students are clamoring for it, and it's very encouraging to me to see that student nurses and nurse practitioners are as well as medical students are really becoming activists, and are, you know, that they care about what the patient's needs are, and they want to have the skills in order to provide those services. So there's Students for Choice groups that are forming, and there are a number of nursing schools and health professional schools that really want to include abortion care and sexual and reproductive health care into their curriculum. And so there is some effort at the University of California in particular, and some other schools that are moving forward with integrating this curriculum. But we have been doing this work all along. We've been training clinicians to provide medication abortion, and also to do a procedure called manual vacuum aspiration, because that is the technique or the procedure that's used to do biopsies, mm-hmm. to you know, for cancer screening. It's also a way to treat unusual uterine bleeding, or to treat a spontaneous abortion like a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. So it's really just about so they've already learned these skills, and they've learned the care of how to help women and their families deal with an unintended pregnancy, and whether they are referred to prenatal care or whether they're referred to, whether they decide on adoption or whether they decide on abortion. You know, this is care that we've been providing all along.
So let me, in the few minutes we have left, ask you about reports that one way that pressure is being put on healthcare providers who are involved in abortion services is by people filing charges of professional misconduct against the health professional. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, instead of focusing on the work of really providing patient care and providing it to people who need it, these anti-abortion groups are attacking abortion providers and nurses and physicians who are providing abortion. And so what they do is that they make complaints to the Board of Nursing or to the Board of Medicine, and these boards are required to investigate any complaint, regardless of its merit, and that in some cases, it's this happened in Oregon, and where there isn't any restriction on who can provide abortion, except that they be licensed and trained and qualified, and so the Board of Nursing did a preliminary investigation and found that there was no merit to it. But even with that minor case, it cost about $5,000 for that nurse to get an attorney and to be represented and to go through even a preliminary investigation. Mm. And in other states, for instance, in a Midwest state, a nurse who an RN who works in an abortion clinic, that the case was motivated by an attorney general, and that case took 2 years to resolve, and there was no merit whatsoever. She was providing safe care. There were some minor infractions that in any other type of care that it would have just been that she would have had to show evidence of developing clinical guidelines. And this just turns your whole life upside down. Yeah. And the worst part of this is that this group is paying thousands of dollars, up to $25,000 for if a health professional, especially. But if someone will make these complaints.
Well, it certainly is of concern, and it looks like the next couple years, at the very least, are going to be very challenging ones for those who are committed to ensuring that women have the right to reproductive health services. And so I thank you for your advocacy, Diana Taylor. I know that you've been a great advocate and activist for protecting women's reproductive rights, including being involved in this study to expand who can provide abortion services and where they can provide them. So I thank you for all the good work you're doing.
Well, thank you. Can I just say one last
Sure.
thing? Because I think we've been talking a lot about abortion, but I think that the reason that I and so many of my colleagues and the majority of health professionals is that, you know, the focus really is not on abortion, but really the focus is really on the respect for women's control of their lives and their fertility, and on the focus on safe, effective, and accessible health services. And so our work is really to make all the tools, all the options available and equally acceptable, and it really puts women at the center of this conversation. So thank you for the opportunity, Diana, to let me talk about this really important area of healthcare.
Very, very well said, Diana. I want to thank you so much for coming on Health Styles. Dr. Diana Taylor is a professor of nursing at the University of California at San Francisco and senior faculty at the UCSF Bixby Center for Reproductive Health.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. You can follow WBAI online at WBAI.org. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. And now for the second part of Health Styles, my interview with Dr. Diane Spatz about breastfeeding.
After decades of the exclusive use of infant formula being viewed as an indicator of social standing and class in the United States, breastfeeding rates in this country are on the rise. But we still have a long way to go. While 75% of American babies are initially breastfed, only 35% are being breastfed exclusively at 3 months. Last year, Save the Children issued a report on the state of the world's mothers that included a breastfeeding policy scorecard. The U.S. ranked last on that scorecard. The scorecard included things like mandates for employers to provide any paid maternity leave after a woman gives birth, and whether the country enacts into law the provisions of an international code for marketing breast milk substitutes. The U.S. requires neither. And yet the evidence on the benefits of breast milk continues to pile up. In fact, breast milk is now used as an intervention to treat very sick or premature newborns who cannot take milk by mouth. And here to talk with us about breastfeeding in the U.S. is Dr. Diane Spatz, a registered nurse and professor of perinatal nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, where she holds the Helene M. Scher Chair in Nutrition. She's also the director of the lactation program and a nurse researcher at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us today, Diane.
Thank you, Diana.
So, Diane, tell us more about how the U.S. is doing on breastfeeding.
Well, we have, in the United States, made some nice strides in improving breastfeeding initiation. And as you mentioned, about 3 out of 4 women now start breastfeeding, which really only means that they fed their baby one time at the breast.
Only one time. That can be initiation.
That's initiation, absolutely, because what they do to collect that data is if the mother reported breastfeeding even just once in the birth hospital, she's counted as a breastfeeder. The fall-off rates for breastfeeding are quite rapid. And in fact, not only are about over a quarter of babies supplemented in birth hospitals, you will see that exclusive breastfeeding rates are quite low, and that at 6 months, it's only about 16% of babies. So we're in the 30% range at 3 months, and only 16% at 6 months. So for myself, as both a nurse researcher, educator, and clinician, I find this very alarming, because what this leads to in our communities is that we have what I like to describe is a community of disgruntled breastfeeders, women who tried breastfeeding, but for whatever reason were not successful, probably because they didn't get evidence-based support and care from their providers, even starting at the birth hospital. So we have so few women, less than 20% breastfeeding exclusively for the first 6 months, that in the United States, women have very few role models for what breastfeeding should look like. And I find this to be so concerning. I actually just today was meeting with a woman who's going to have her baby at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia because of a concern related to the baby's brain. And she shared with me her first breastfeeding experience with her daughter 3 years ago and told me some of the information that she received from a birth hospital that just went against all evidence. And it's just, it's a real challenge, I think, still today for us to help women make sure that they're getting the best start to breastfeeding so that they can be successful.
So let's talk about a concrete example. I hear women all the time say, well, I couldn't continue to breastfeed because I didn't produce enough milk for my baby.
So perceived insufficient milk supply. It's actually a worldwide phenomena. Women don't think their baby is getting enough, or how do I know my baby is getting enough? And I think in particular in our U.S. culture, we are so focused on numbers and measurement and time and being able to know exactly, you know, what's going on. To think about breastfeeding, women almost have to, you know, take a leap of faith that, of course, my breasts are going to work. Of course, this is what they're cut out to do. But if you start with breastfeeding, what you want to know is that in pregnancy already, the breast is preparing to make milk. So a woman starts secreting colostrum from about 16 weeks of pregnancy on. So even if she delivered a very preterm infant, her breasts are still prepared to make milk. The way that a mother knows how to continue to make milk is by the demand on the breast. So the more the breast is stimulated and emptied, the more milk that is produced. And this supply and demand concept can go on for as long as the breast is stimulated. The first week to two after delivery, though, is critical because the hormones of lactation are primed at that point. And so in the early breastfeeding experience, it's important for that mother to have continuous, uninterrupted skin-to-skin contact with her baby, a practice that many birth hospitals don't currently allow or support. The mother needs to be able to breastfeed the baby on the baby's cues without having to supplement the baby with formula. And she needs to be able to have time just to spend with the baby to breastfeed. And many women don't have accurate guidance or have realistic expectations about what breastfeeding is going to look like. And babies can eat a lot. Babies can eat every 2 to 3 hours. Research where we've looked at breastfeeding patterns of babies show that babies can eat anywhere between about 7 and 19 breasts per day. And that's a really big range of what normal looks like.
Feedings from the breast.
Like from one breast. So as few as 7, meaning one breast, and as many as 19, meaning they're always feeding from both breasts at once. So the baby will drive maternal supply, but if mom isn't counseled on what normal feeding behavior looks like, what feeding cues look like, because babies tell us when they're hungry before they cry, and what signs of satiation look like, moms might think a fussy baby is a hungry baby, but it's a fussy baby, and it has nothing to do with feeding. So this whole concept of how do I know my baby's getting enough is something that women do struggle with, and it's hard for them if they're also getting mixed messages about their milk supply from the start. So if they go into a hospital, deliver a baby, and they say, oh, yes, we want you to breastfeed, but you need to supplement your baby because your baby has lost too much weight, or because you're not doing it correctly, or, you know, whatever reason that they tell the mom. And so I think for mothers, oftentimes right away from the time of delivery or birth hospital, many women feel very vulnerable, or they feel set up for failure because they're getting mixed messages about them, about how to breastfeed and how breastfeeding should work.
So, Diane, you have a lot of experience with helping women, and often women who have difficulties with breastfeeding, to actually be successful. What percent of the women that you work with, or what do we know from the data, from research, what percent of women cannot breastfeed?
So so when you think about not being able to make milk at all, right, unless a woman had no breasts, if she had breast cancer and had bilateral mastectomy and had no breast tissue at all, that's the only mom who's not going to be able to make any milk. Even when we have cases where a mother who has had breast surgery, for example, breast reduction, which can alter milk supply, or if a mother has a true condition called glandular hypoplasia, which means there's not a sufficient amount of glandular tissue that has developed, those mothers still can make milk. They may not, however, be able to make a full supply to exclusively breastfeed their babies. The incidence of true glandular hypoplasia is less than 2% of the population.
Okay. And so this idea of exclusive breastfeeding, one of the things you hear, if I'm breastfeeding my child, you hear that you're supposed to introduce solid foods at some point, or that you should have the child be used to formula just so that if something happens and you can't be there, that the child will be able to get nourishment.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so I really, when I hear people say, oh, just give the baby some formula to make sure the baby will take it, why? Why? If a mother can't be with her child all the time, we are fortunate enough to live in a culture in the United States where we have breast pump technology easily available. Women can get access to pumps at, you know, Babies R Us, Target. You can buy an electric breast pump for a pretty reasonable price. And with the Affordable Care Act, some women are beginning to see some better coverage for getting breast pumps and whatnot. But the idea that the baby needs to have something else is not based on research. And if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics or the World Health Organization, they really emphasize that need for exclusive human milk feeds for the first 6 months. And when you talk about exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months, that's either direct breastfeeding at the breast or feeding that expressed milk via a bottle if mom and baby are separated. So our goal should really be to help mothers achieve that exclusive human milk feeding for the first 6 months. And right now, you know, as I mentioned, that's less than 20% of women who are doing that.
And so why is this so important? What are some of the, you know, it just sort of makes intuitive sense that the mother's milk is going to be better than any other milk. But indeed, there's been a lot of research on what some of the benefits are, and maybe you could share just a few of those benefits.
Sure. So one of the things that we know about breastfeeding or feeding human milk to an infant is that it's a dose-response benefit. And for different illnesses or diseases, a baby would have to have a different dose of milk to get a benefit. And so I'll explain that through a couple of examples. So for example, with gastroenteritis or diarrhea, okay, any amount of breastfeeding is going to decrease the baby's chance of gastroenteritis. It's about a 64% risk reduction just with any human milk in the diet, okay? But if you wanted to, say, for example, have protection for the baby from respiratory illnesses or respiratory tract infections, the research really shows that you need exclusive breastfeeding for 4 to 6 months. If you look at something like necrotizing enterocolitis, which is a disease we see in babies in the NICU where their bowel dies.
Neonatal intensive care unit.
In the neonatal intensive care unit, the disease called necrotizing enterocolitis where the bowel dies is something that is a very scary and serious disease. We know that if babies get fed human milk through their NICU stay, there's a 77% reduced risk in NEC. So, for example, in a neonatal intensive care unit, you really don't have any business putting anything but human milk into a baby's belly.
And so, if the infant can't nurse because they're too immature, they're too premature, what have you, the practice is now, the best practice is still to instill somehow through a nasogastric tube into the stomach, the milk because of these benefits?
Correct. So if the baby is doesn't have the gestational maturity to be able to coordinate suck, swallow, breathe, or if the baby had a complication, for example, cleft lip or cleft palate, where you wouldn't be able to directly breastfeed the baby at the breast, then we can administer mom's own milk through a feeding tube, an NG tube, which is a small tube that goes into their nose and their belly. There's also, with other types of sick babies, we can feed milk via a G tube, which goes right into their stomach. But the preferred form of not only nutrition, but really medicine for a baby in intensive care is to get 100% human milk diet.
And Diane, I heard you speak a few months ago about how breast milk is being used to treat different conditions in newborns and newborns who cannot suck themselves. And you were talking about even just putting the breast milk in their mouths.
Absolutely.
Tell us about
oral
that.
Care.
Yeah, oral
absolutely.
Care.
So oral care with human milk, this is really an exciting thing to think about, because if you think about a healthy term breastfed baby, a healthy term breastfed baby is eating every 2 to 3 hours. So that means the inside of that baby's mouth is always coated with his mom's milk, okay? Human milk is a very powerful antimicrobial agent. So if you took a bottle of mom's milk or human milk and you put a bacteria in it, the milk would kill it. If you took a virus and put it in the milk would kill it. So by keeping the baby's mouth coated with milk, it's like a force field, really, or a frontline protection against infectious germs, processes. Babies can also absorb some of the small proteins from mom's milk through their cheeks or through their buccal mucosa. So they can actually absorb some of the immune properties through their system even without putting the milk in their belly.
It's fascinating work, and let me just remind listeners that you're listening to Health Styles, and we're talking with Diane Spatz. She is, a professor of perinatal nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, as well as the director of the lactation program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we're talking about breastfeeding today. So, Diane, in the short time we have left, could you talk a little bit about, if it has all of these benefits, what's our problem? What's getting in the way of having higher exclusive breastfeeding rates at 6 months?
Well, the list is pretty long, Diana.
What do you think is the most important factor?
I'm going to start with two things. First is hospital support, and then second is community support. Hospitals, all right? There is an initiative called the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative, which involves 10 steps that help mothers get to the best start for breastfeeding. To be a baby friendly hospital, it's quite an intense process to go through that certification. And the hospital also has to not accept free infant formula. As you mentioned at the start of our interview, the United States is one of the few countries that has not signed on to the code of marketing for breast milk substitutes. So we definitely, in America, we're a capitalistic society, and formula is big business. And so if you don't think formula is influencing, or the formula companies aren't influencing what is on Capitol Hill, then you're misled, because they have very deep pockets. So the support that moms get already in the birth hospital is not often ideal to get breastfeeding off to the best start.
But what you're saying is that if you go to a baby-friendly hospital, it's called baby-friendly hospital,
yep,
that you can count on having that support. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And in New York City, you have Harlem Hospital, which was one of the first hospitals to become baby-friendly.
That's good to know.
But overall, it's only about 6% of births in the United States that occur in baby-friendly facilities.
Now, so, we should also point out that child birthing centers, freestanding birth centers,
absolutely,
have a higher rate of breastfeeding, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mothers who are cared for by nurse midwives and advanced practice nurses who give birth in freestanding birth facilities, absolutely, you see much better breastfeeding outcomes.
And what about community support?
So in the community, we have a community of women and families who don't have a lot of breastfeeding role models. And so if you look at the father or the partner, if you look at the grandmother, many women today who are giving birth to children, they weren't breastfed by their mothers. So if their mother didn't breastfeed and she said, well, I formula fed you and you turned out okay, you know, she doesn't have the role models to be able to get the support. So mothers need support from their partners, from their family members, from the grandparents. They need support in the community to be comfortable with breastfeeding in public, that they shouldn't feel harassed by breastfeeding if they had to go to a store or to a mall. They need to be supported in their workplace to be able to express milk. And the Affordable Care Act has workplace accommodations, but those workplace accommodations are for women who are hourly employees. So it doesn't cover women who are salaried employees. So there could be the chance that a woman might not be supported at expressing milk at work, even if she is a salaried employee and has, for example, more economic means. So the Affordable Care Act, while it's great that we now have some law on the books in terms of the protection of breastfeeding upon the return to work, it really is not as strong as it needs to be to help women be successful. Women also don't know about the law. That's another big piece of the equation, because it's not like employers are actively out there saying, hey, we want you to breastfeed and we're going to make it easy for you when you come back to work.
So we were talking today with Dr. Diane Spatz, who is a registered nurse and a professor of perinatal nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, director of lactation program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Diane, you have a longstanding reputation as a breastfeeding advocate. So for people who would like to do something about this issue, is there a way that they can contact you about what they might do in their own communities or workplaces?
Absolutely. The best way to reach me is if you go to the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing's website, which is www.nursing.upenn, which is UPENN.edu. And on the School of Nursing's website, there is a faculty search box, and you can just put in my name, Diane Spatz, and it will give you my email as well as my phone number.
And the Spatz is spelled?
S-P-A-T-Z.
Great. Well, and I think you've given some great ideas for our listeners, and even for those who are not looking to be breastfeeding anytime soon, or maybe are way past that point, or never had the potential to do it, it is about creating healthy communities and healthy environments and healthy families. And so I would urge our listeners to pay attention to what is going on in your workplace. Is there a policy on providing women with the opportunity to express milk or to even breastfeed at work if they need to? And when you know somebody who's going to be delivering a baby in a hospital, ask that person, is this a baby-friendly hospital? And if not, maybe you ought to tell the hospital they ought to become a baby-friendly hospital or get other support, a lactation specialist who might support you through this very crucial time in your life and in your baby's life. So thank you so much, Diane, for coming on to Health Styles today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Diana.
So, again, please take some make some effort to try to improve what we're doing here in this country on breastfeeding. It's a really important issue. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of Health Styles. Health Styles is brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Have a great day.